Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review is back today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And the reason Jim wasn't here yesterday is because he had taken the train up to New York to appear on CNN. And Jim, you were there on a momentous day as Corey Lewandowski had been fired by the Trump campaign. And if my calculations are correct, he showed up on CNN set not long after you had. So any altercations in the hallway you want to tell us about?
Yeah, he grabbed me. No, must have been on a different floor. I suppose you could kind of say that Lewandowski, whatever you think of him, his loyalty should be saluted. I mean, he went out there, did not take a long time to start doing interviews. And in a circumstance most people would say, when you've been kind of unceremoniously dumped, and I would argue being treated as a scapegoat for the troubles of the campaign, Mr. Trump is the kindest, warmest, most wonderful human being I've ever met, and kind of a little Manchurian candidate in his loyalty. I mean, some of the Branch Davidians ran, for perspective. There, Craig. I guess Lewandowski is a true believer, and I guess we're foreshadowing one of our martinis today.
Yeah, probably the crazy one. All right, on to the good martini today. And yesterday, Ian Tuttle and I, in our bad martini, talked about how Loretta Lynch had gone on Meet the Press saying, yeah, we're going to release these partial transcripts of the Orlando shooter negotiating with the 911 and police hostage negotiators. And Chuck Todd says, what do you mean partial? And she says, well, we're not going to include the parts where he's saying who he's pledging allegiance to. We don't want to foster that kind of propaganda. So we got these redacted transcripts in the first part of the day on Monday where he says, I want you to know I'm in Orlando and I did the shootings. What's your name? My name is I pledge allegiance to omitted. What's your name? I pledge allegiance to omitted. All right, where are you at? I'm in Orlando. So finally, after all the blowback yesterday, the Justice Department eventually releases the unredacted transcripts from that portion of the conversation. And surprise, surprise, he's saying, I pledge allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi of the Islamic State. By the end of the day, a lot of egg on the face of the administration, but oh, not at the White House, because Josh Earnest is making it perfectly clear the president had nothing to do with this.
This is a decision that was made entirely by the Department of Justice and by officials at the FBI.
Consultation with the office of the president?
Look, I can't speak to every single conversation, but I'm not aware of one.
So the censorship was not at all reviewed here?
It was not. This is a decision that was made solely by officials at the Department of Justice and the FBI, consistent with their need to be as transparent as possible about the investigation, but also make sure that they could advance the investigation by eliciting additional information about the suspect from the public.
Might they have received some guidance beforehand from here?
No, they did not.
We had absolutely nothing to do with it whatsoever, Jim. So do you think do you think Josh Earnest is lying, or do you think the Justice Department just assumed that given after 7.5 years of precedent, this is what the president wanted them to do?
Loretta, look out for that bus! Oh, no. Probably the only person who feels more blindsided by a lack of support from their boss yesterday was Corey Lewandowski. Okay, this was really a bizarre set of circumstances from the... Because, like, one... FBI Director Comey had already said, like it was already open, that witnesses had said, they talk about him pledging his support for ISIS and things like that. So it seemed really odd that they would even try to hide any of this message or obscure any of it or omit any of it. Then the part that they did was exceptionally clear. Now, I'm going to give the Department of Justice and FBI a little more sympathy than they might expect to say that maybe the fear is if they release the audio tape, ISIS will use it in future propaganda videos. We can argue about whether that's the right call, but I guess I can see where they're coming from on that. But the reason to not show a full transcript and to leave everything there, it just doesn't seem to make any sense. And then the eventual claim of, oh, well, that would end up re-victimizing the families of the victims. It just doesn't, but they already know that it was ISIS and this guy was pledging himself to Baghdadi. And we learned quite a bit once they released that portion of it, because he's using, basically, he used, for a guy who didn't speak Arabic, he was speaking a certain amount of Arabic phrases, meaning he'd been studying up on this. And ISIS had said, when you pledge to us, don't pledge to us as a group, pledge to our leader al-Baghdadi. So there was something kind of revealing and edifying about that. Now, and again, it didn't seem like there was any real national security value. The reason this is the good martini is a whole lot of folks from Paul Ryan on down basically said, this is ridiculous, this makes no sense, and just let us see what he actually said. If you don't want to do audio, at least give us a full transcript. Finally, they did. Very rarely do you see the administration back down on something like this. So to give them a little bit of credit, they saw they'd made a mistake. It probably took a great, you know, more public outrage than it should have. But now we at least have this portion of the transcript. They've at least avoided the silly omission that, you know, everybody could pretty much tell exactly what he was saying.
Yeah, especially after all the reports that came out last week. So anyway, speaking of stories that people don't seem to be interested in the motivation for or in reporting at all, let's move to our bad martini today. This is courtesy of the excellent reporting work of one Jim Garrity over at National Review. You would think the headline, "Illegal Immigrant Tries to Kill Donald Trump," would be a big deal. And you quote the story from Las Vegas. The man facing charges for attempting to grab a police officer's gun so he could allegedly shoot presidential candidate Donald Trump is in the United States illegally. He had overstayed his visa from the United Kingdom. That information came during his arraignment in U.S. District Court Monday afternoon. Michael Sanford, 20, is charged with an act of violence on restricted grounds. He was arrested Saturday during Trump's campaign rally in Las Vegas. Police said he grabbed the handle of an officer's gun in an attempt to remove it. According to the complaint, Sanford told police he drove from California to Las Vegas to kill Trump. Jim, we've had a lot of problems with the Trump campaign, Trump himself, certainly. One thing we've been pretty consistent, though, is in defending him and his supporters that they should not be the targets of violence and certainly deadly violence. They have the right to speak. And the fact that the media is essentially burying the attempted assassination of a presumptive Republican presidential nominee is stunning.
Yeah, I put this up in the corner. An illegal immigrant tried to kill Donald Trump. This is a big deal, isn't it? And some folks are basically saying no, which is, you know, because he didn't succeed. He didn't come close enough to succeeding to make this big news. All he did was get a hand on a gun from a policeman. Okay, I'm not buying that. The second thing is that this is a UK immigrant. He entered the country legally. He's very young. Apparently, he's got mental problems. It makes me wondering, like, maybe we shouldn't, if you're crazy, we shouldn't let you into this country. I'm not sure, like, whether we can test for that, but it just seemed like a odd choice that this is a deeply troubled young man. And then somebody said, well, because he's white, because he's from the UK, Republicans don't get upset about that. Greg, I don't like visa overstays. Do you?
Not at all. I don't care where they're from.
It's a fair argument to say that if you want to talk about a border wall or southern border security, which Trump discusses a great deal, that you'd only deal with about 6 million out of the 11 million illegal immigrants in this country, that the remaining 5 million are people who come to the United States legally, either on a tourism visa or a temporary work visa or something like that. And then when it expires, they don't leave, right? And I guess the thinking is, you know, these people aren't as dangerous. But you know what? They're still in violation of the law. I kind of am marveling that in a world where we have the ability to track packages across the country, Uber can tell me exactly where my car is. The iCloud can tell you where you left your iPad or your iPhone. But we have no ability to keep track of people once they enter the country. And people are saying, well, what do you want to do, Jim? Put surgically implant trackers in every one of them? Not as a first step, Greg. A little more seriously, like, you know, to get an entry visa to the United States, it costs about $160, and you know, I assume a lot of these people pay for this with a credit card. I'm kind of sitting there saying, could we at least track the credit card? Could we at least try to use that? Could we cancel the credit card? Could we put a hold on it? Are we even trying on this? Considering the fact that there's an estimate about 500,000 people overstayed their visa last year, and the estimate about 5 million people are living in this country illegally on an expired visa, there's kind of this sense that these people don't fear enforcement of this, and nobody seems to be all that concerned about that. So, you know, maybe this doesn't fit the narrative of illegal immigrants or something like that, but it's kind of this odd, disturbing, nagging sense that because it doesn't fit the narrative, the media just doesn't know what to do with it and doesn't want to spend much time doing it.
That was going to be my next question. Is it being ignored because it's Trump, because it's an illegal immigrant, or both? Hard to say, but I think
we can embrace the healing power of and.
Exactly. So there you go, Trump fans. We stood up for your guy.
I put it to somebody, I'm never Trump, but I'm also never assassination.
Yes.
This shouldn't be so surprising a stance for us.
Yeah, we shouldn't pat ourselves on the back too much for wanting him to stay alive. But nonetheless, it's time now to look at a slightly different story regarding the Trump campaign. And this broke last night, and it regards the Trump campaign's filing with the Federal Elections Commission about what it did in May, and the answer is not much. Trump finished the month with $1.3 million cash on hand. In contrast, Hillary Clinton has $42 million on hand. Meanwhile, Trump spent most of that month with no opposition. and Hillary was going all the way to the finish with Bernie Sanders. Other things that were fun is that the biggest campaign expenditure, even more than paying his entire staff for May, was renting out Mar-a-Lago, which he owns. In Florida, they spent more money on hats than they did in online advertising. And basically, this looks like a campaign that has no idea what it's doing and is largely out of money. Kind of funny for a guy who's supposedly worth billions and billions of dollars. So, Jim, how serious is this candidacy?
Oh, I was about to say, how serious are these problems? And I was about to say, extremely serious. And now it'd be like, look, you know, it's fascinating to see the defenses of the Trumpers. In response, one is there are some people keep on, well, he's worth $10 billion. Okay, but if he refuses to spend any of his own money, that $10 billion doesn't do any good, right? It, you know, the suspicion is that he's not worth the full $10 billion. Some have theorized that he's not even worth $1 billion. But even if he is, the large amount of it comes from owning skyscrapers and owning buildings, and it's illiquid. Right? You can't just sell it overnight and get a lot of cash for it unless you're willing to make a very bad deal. And we all know Donald Trump wrote the art of the deal and all that stuff.
Only the best deals.
So $1.3 million. That's not a lot of money for a House campaign to have in the bank at this point of the campaign. We're about a month away from this. They've already pretty much announced that the RNC has to do all the get-out-the-vote operations. What are they doing? I mean, basically, it sounds like under Corey Lewandowski, the attitude was we're going to do one or two big rally events a day. It's going to dominate local cable news. He's going to put out a lot of tweets. He's going to do a lot of interviews, and that's going to be all we need. Well, and because that worked in the primary – They're totally convinced this is going to work in the general election. Well, we're going to have 120, 125 million people voting in the general election, right? We had maybe 25 million people vote in the Republican primary. It's a much bigger universe of people. And there's a lot more people you have to reach out to. And you know, for the great revolutions of the Obama campaign in 2008 and 2012, where they got really good at get out the vote, and they brought out voters where they were there, and Trump doesn't want to do any of this. He also doesn't seem to want to do any of the fundraising. So he's in terrible shape on fundraising. The Hillary campaign is dominating the airwaves, and he's not on them, at least in paid commercials. I guess the thinking is that if there's enough good coverage of Trump in between the commercials, you can completely concede that. So the only thing Trump needs to win this, Greg, is for the media to be nice to him. That's all we need. That's right, you know. So, you know, it's not surprising you're hearing greater and greater murmurs about, can we change this in Cleveland? Can there be a revolt of the delegates? Because at this point, polling out today didn't look very good for him. The fundraising numbers look terrible. He's getting clobbered on the airwaves. And each day he creates some new controversy about himself rather than making the case against Hillary Clinton and making the case against another 4 years of Democratic rule in the White House and not making the case for Republicans in the Senate, Republicans in the House who want to keep it. We want to keep those things. He's doing none of these things. And so at this point for the Republican delegates, just how much do you have to lose if you try this last-minute Hail Mary effort to replace him? You need about 300 Trump delegates to change their minds and go against him. Obviously not particularly good odds, but the plane is heading towards the mountain, as somebody put it. Do you want to change direction or not?
No, that's certainly right. It's almost like it's all about himself and he's not really worried about the rest of the party. It almost seems that way.
It almost is that, or almost like he's got zero impulse control.
Oh,
happy Tuesday, everybody.
Happy Tuesday. You got the new Quinnipiac polls out, though, showing him in a dead heat in Ohio and Pennsylvania, but now down 8 to Hillary in Florida. And I forgot who ran those numbers, but basically, if Hillary wins the 19 states that the Democrats have won every year since 1992, plus Florida, none of the rest matters. So Trump would have to turn Pennsylvania or Michigan or both or a lot more other states than that he's unlikely to win. So the tea leaves not looking good for Donald Trump at all.
The other thing I was going to say is that the that Quinnipiac poll, they were polling people for 11 days, Greg.
Yes.
That's kind of long. I don't want him to seem like one of those guys who poo-poos any poll that doesn't give him the result he wants or something like that. Look, you know, maybe Trump's doing okay in Ohio and Pennsylvania. I'd like to see this from other polls. I'm not saying that Quinnipiac poll is garbage. I'm just saying it's possible that one end of the poll, Hillary's having a good couple of days. The other end of the poll, Trump is having a good couple of days. And they even out because you've been polling for such a long stretch of time. So we'll see how it shakes out. But just add that little asterisk to that poll.
On that note, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Karembas of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.